Lee. And with that, Representative Lewick, would you care to move the minutes of the meeting from March 15th?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So moved.
Motion, is there discussion? If not, all in favor of approving the minutes of March 15th, say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Minutes are approved. Thank you. We're going to do some shuttling of our agenda this morning because folks already have bills and other committees with our short session coming up. So we're going to start with Representative Backer and Bill number 2938 as he makes his way up to the table. Good morning, Vice Chair Backer. Would you care to move your bill?
Yes, thank you, Chair Anderson and members. I move that House File 2938 be referred to the Committee of Government Operations and Elections.
Very good. Representative Backer, please present your bill.
Yes, and I have some testifiers, too, after I get done there, or you're welcome to come up right now. But overview of this bill, what it does is extends the 10 years of Minnesota Agriculture Fertilizer Research and Education Council, and we won't be saying that every time today, so AFREC, and the fertilizing inspection fee surcharge of 40% per ton. And what that does, members, is it's funds that's used for fertilizing research, education, technology, transfers, grants, awards for each year. Without this extension, the surcharge would expire in 2019, and then AFREC would expire in 2020. So what this does is we extend AFREC until June 30th of 2030. We also extend the AFREC surcharge until June 30th of 2029. And then it also extends the AFREP administration program until June 30th of 2030, and also does the same thing for the account holders. And then,
Representative Backer, just to back up a second, maybe I didn't hear you correctly. Did you say that the fee or tax was 40% per ton or 40 cents?
40 cents.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Representative.
Yeah, that's a little less there. I think we would have people come down here and after us at 40%, so thank you. And I'm done. Go ahead.
Hey, your testifier, sir. Good morning. Identify yourself for the record, please, and then proceed.
Chairman Anderson, committee members, for the record, I'm Paul Dronenberg from Grant County, and I've worked with for over 35 years with fertilizer recommendations and growers in west central Minnesota, and that's a lot of critical decisions for fertilizer, but I'm the chair of AFRAC, and I would like to take just a few minutes to give you an overview of the AFRAC and what the what it means for this valuable program to be extended. AFRAC stands for Agriculture, Fertilizer, and Research and Education Council. It's a 12-member council representing 11 commodity groups, and that gives a broad representation of much of the ag community. And AFRAC ensures that Minnesota farmers and ag dealerships get the best possible research and recommendations and scientific advancements to make good decisions in their fertilizer recommendations. Just like to go over just a little bit of what the council does. AFRAC council develops funding priorities each year, makes all the funding decisions. We have annual reviews of ongoing projects. We coordinate with other research efforts through the various commodity groups, and we coordinate efforts with MDA staff and various project research leaders to ensure maximum efficiency for the program. One of AFRAC's missions is to improve fertilizer efficiency, improve profitability, and improve Minnesota's environment. Now, this AFRAC started in 2008, and then in 2009, the legislature established a long-term funding mechanism with a tonnage fee increase of 40 cents per ton, which finances the research. But the initial sunset clause was from 2008 to 2018, which is also a 10-year sunset clause at that time, but then thank you for the legislature did extend that to 2020. So that's where we would be going from with our present extension. But since the conception of AFRAC, we have funded over $7.4 million of soil fertility research and associated education programs. And also that was with $25 million in applications and requests for research. So you can see from 25, sorting it down from 25 million to 7.4, we are funding less than a third of the applications. There's a lot of applications for research. And in that 7.4 million, there was 149 individual research projects that were funded. And most of those were University of Minnesota projects. But a couple specific examples to give you an idea of some of the specifics. There's been less dependency on anhydrous. And as a result, we've been doing more work with urea and other nitrogen sources. And that emphasizes placement and more efficient use of these sources so that the farmers can use them efficiently. Another example is sulfur. About 10 years ago, there wasn't much sulfur used. And because of some of the fine-tuning of fertilizer manufacturers and less sulfur in the atmosphere, we started to see sulfur symptoms in the field. So there was a lot of research went into that the last 5 to 7 years to fine-tune this to get to the right soil types, the right crops, the right rates to get a better feel, give the farmers a better feel for what the application rate should be. And another important one is the research and the education and outreach. That's been something that we've been really emphasizing the last few years. That's always been a major part of that, to get the research out to the growers, out to the dealers, so that they get the latest research. But the challenge is to get it out there in a timely fashion. As many of you know, radio, magazines, newsletters has been a regular vehicle, but we've got additional opportunity now with smartphones and iPads, and the farmers can get out at those research findings anytime, anywhere, whether they're in the field or doing their planning, or that's been a very good vehicle, so we've pursued that in the last couple of years. So over the last 2 years, our research and outreach funding has went from like 10 to 30% of our budget because to take advantage of these opportunities with the newer technology. And I want to emphasize that we have 100% support from our members, from our council members, to extend the sunset clause for to 10 years and support this bill. We're recommending we keep the fee the same, 40 cents per ton, keep the existing structure. It's working well. And MDA has been the fiscal administrator and providing day-to-day support for the AFRAC council also. So over seven of our members provided letters of support, which I did email to Representative Backer and Representative Anderson. And if others would like to see that, we can make that happen too. But anyway, that completes my words, and thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Groneberg. And with your years of experience advising farmers with Central and whatever else you do, you're kind of a legend out there in western Minnesota, so thank you for your work. Are there questions from members? Representative Bly.
Thank you, Chair. And to the testifier, this is somewhat an esoteric question, so it came from somebody who just emailed me and wanted to know if there was research being done in this one area. Apparently, there was an incident where nitrogen truck had carrying nitrogen and something called a nitrogen extender had gotten into a water treatment system and had wiped out some microbes that help break down the waste. And their question is, do you know if anything, any kind of research has been done to look at this issue, or whether or not it's an issue that you ever heard of? I don't know a great deal about it, but I thought I'd ask on the behalf of this person that sent me the email.
Mr. Groneberg.
There are a couple of different types of extenders, so I'd have to answer that really specific, I'd have to know. But by an extender, usually that can interfere with the microbes can break down nitrogen into other forms. And so, and that's usually temporary, but it's long enough usually it preserves the nitrogen so it doesn't get into a leachable form. A situation like yours is unconventional, but I wouldn't think it would last too long unless it was really concentrated.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because the concentration would affect how long the effect would remain.
But as far as you know, there hasn't been...
Representative Bly?
I'm sorry, excuse me, Chair. There hasn't been any research at this point done to that, but you do have some knowledge about how that works or how that could happen.
Mr. Groneberg.
There's been a lot of research done on that.
Oh, there has. Okay.
Yes. As far as from the standpoint of being in a well and being out of place, that part I can't answer.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Mr. Groneberg, just a quick question. You know, a lot of discussion on nitrogen and the use of nitrogen and such. Could you just make a general statement of nitrogen use over the years and how many pounds of N it takes to produce a bushel of corn and the trends you see in the use of nitrogen raising corn over the years?
Chairman Anderson, the trends have definitely been up because, as you know, the yield trends have been up. And as a rule of thumb, somewhere between 0.9 to 1 pound of nitrogen per bushel is what is used. And, of course, if you're shooting for 240 bushels, it's a lot different than 180 bushel. But the trend is definitely up.
Yeah.
And actually what's interesting is as the bushels go up, we're finding that it takes less nitrogen per bushel to produce that bushel because the efficiency seems to be there also.
Yeah. I was in a meeting about a year ago with the attachments available to corn planters and such and the wide tubes and such, and farmers are really applying it more precisely at the right times and doing a much better job of getting that end down to when the plant needs it. Would you agree with that?
Yes, definitely, because there's more side dressing and placing it at the right time, and that influence that makes it a lot more efficient.
Very good. Thank you. Anybody in the audience who would care to testify in favor of or against the bill? Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is a naive, used to be a farm kid kind of question. And I haven't been around agriculture for 30 years. The context of the research that's being done by your agency or through this result of this bill and these funds, is it in parallel to, is it in checking on the private research? Because obviously my logic would tell me that the producers, the fertilizer manufacturers, are the ones that do leading research as to whether something will work, might work, and all that sort of thing, or a different formulation of a product for a benefit. Are you doing research that checks on that, or are you doing research in parallel so that you might advise them toward what you would consider to be beneficial types of products? Just sort of looking for the relationship between this agency and the private world that produces product.
Mr. Groneberg.
I might have to rely on somebody else in the audience, but Bill, you might be able to answer this, but... Unlike a lot of the chemical industry where the companies do a lot of research, to my knowledge, there's not a lot done by the fertilizer industry. And up until about 10 years ago, a lot of it was done, I think, through the university from the fertilizer industry. But as of about the time AFRIC was started, the university research had went down a little bit to it. And so... this is one of the main research arms that's going on now as far as fertilizer. And, Bill, you might be able to expand on that.
Identify yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is Bill Bond. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Crop Production Retailers, a trade association of the crop input industry here in Minnesota, and also we administer the Certified Crop Advisors, and I'm a board member, a alternate board member for AFRAC as well. The industry does a tremendous amount of research, and the Fertilizer Institute on a national level has, of which we're affiliated at the state level, has done extensive research. In fact, they've come up with a program that summarizes that called the 4R program, and it really talks about the system and the way that we can take the fertilizer, each of those elements, and blend it into how it impacts the soil for maximum efficiency, which is also the minimal environmental impact. So what's going on with AFRAC is essentially more of a Minnesota-specific, soil-specific, and product-specific additional research other than what the industry has done on a broader level across the country and around the world. So I think this is a real parallel and partnering effort, but it builds upon what's happening here in Minnesota.
Although Representative Salk?
That's it. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Bond, you were Representative Bly.
Thank you, Chair. So I think the research is encouraging, and the comments that the Chair made about efficiencies and things like that with the nitrogen. I guess I'm wondering, though, in visiting with farmers in my own district, I know that there are farmers who are really trying to do a very efficient job of the application of nitrogen, but I also know that there are some farmers who maybe don't and maybe don't pay attention to those signals. What efforts are being made to help those farmers who either don't understand or don't think it's that important to bring them along to follow the kinds of prescriptions that you're learning through your research that is the best practices?
Mr. Bond?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As a matter of fact, I'm really proud to say that our organization received a grant from the Minnesota Department of Agriculture to take what we call precision agriculture, which is making the precise best application not only per field but within a grid, soil sample part of the field. And what we're doing is taking the elements of the Ag Water Quality Certification Program and building it into the system and marketing of ag retailers and how they market to their growers. And what we're finding is that precision ag is being adopted more and more each year because it's imperative that farmers get the best, most efficient use of fertilizer. It is an expensive crop input. And so I would say we are seeing this move through the natural commercial extension of precision ag. And I think we're seeing a real improvement in efficiency. And the research we're doing is actually asking the question, do farmers and do retailers find it useful to have essentially a pre-certification metric score that they can look at and apply to their own fields? So it's been a very positive effort and one that we're real proud of.
Representative Salk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick extension of what you just talked about. So is it a reasonable or correct for me to make the assumption that the actual price of this product in a very thin margin is probably the strongest discipline to either overuse or misuse or haphazard application, all of the negatives that probably in the past we would have been more correct in assuming. I remember watching my dad put all of this stuff together and we planted corn. And, you know, there was an incredible amount of what I'll just phrase as slop in the system. And yet I know that even Dad in his operation was extraordinarily tight with the dime. And so even then already, the discipline of the price of this product weighed heavily in how you used it.
Mr. Bond?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I think you've nailed it absolutely. The high cost of inputs has a tremendous discipline in it, and the growers have to use discipline, and they do. But it's not just the cost. There are other factors that we're learning much more, thanks to university and other research that's going on, about how different kinds of fertilizer impact the soil and how they're taken up and how they impact the environment. it's not only commercial fertilizer. Of course, manure is another piece of how plants are fertilized. So learning how these are interacting is a constant scientific endeavor, and we're getting better and better at it. And I think you would be right to conclude what you did.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Seeing no further, Mr. Bond, any more testimony? Okay, thank you very much. With that, Representative Back, would you care to renew your motion?
Yeah, Chair and members, I would renew my motion for House File 2938 to be referred to the Committee of Government Operations and Elections.
With that motion by the representative, all in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion passes, and the bill is on its way. Thanks, Vice Chair Banker. The next bill up, House File 1831. Representative Munson, would you care to move the bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that the House File 1831 be re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Regulatory Reform.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Representative Lunan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, members, for hearing my bill. First of all, I've got an A18 amendment to get the bill in order that I would like to move.
Representative Munson?
Yep, I move that the A18 Amendment 0560 be also moved.
Any questions for members on the A18 amendment? Seeing none, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. Representative Lunan, to your bill as amended.
Members, overview of this bill, and I've got some testifiers here today. This was actually brought to me by the Minnesota Grape and Wine and Producers and Growers and the Apple Guild. And what they want to do is they're kind of taking a horizon look at their industry and seeing from a promotional standpoint, from a developmental standpoint, and an educational standpoint, things they can do long-term to not only defend the viability but increase the viability of their industry. We've got the University of Minnesota here today to testify on some of the developments that they're working on here. But what it does is it forms a 15-person council that has three-year terms, and each year one-third of that council will rotate to create a legacy. It's a cross-section. If you look at the bill, a cross-section of everyone involved. We've got wine producers. We've got grape growers. We've got Explore Minnesota for the promotional aspect of the bill. We've got Licensed Beverage Association, which obviously plays a role in this also, and the Cider Guild. And what it is funded by is revenue from an equalization of the tax on direct providers and what a direct shipper, or sorry, direct shippers. And what a direct shipper is a someone who produces the product that doesn't sell it through a retailer. They sell it directly to the consumer. And right now, producers in Minnesota pay a tax on that. A direct shipper outside of the state of Minnesota who is shipping directly to your home, for instance, do not pay that tax. This bill attempts to equalize that and put to work that revenue to improve the industry. And I'd like to call up my first testifier.
Okay. And I'd remind members as your testifier is coming down that this bill has many stops on its way to the floor, and the purview of this committee would be as it pertains to agriculture and ag policies. Good morning, sir. Identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Steve Unverzat. I'm the on the board of directors for the Minnesota Grape Growers Association. Have been for 5 years. I'm going to speak briefly to the promotion, education, and development aspect of this bill. The current status and possible future needs for and applications for the funding. Right now, the marketing programs are creating demand for more grapes and vineyards, and there's about 1,500 acres in Minnesota currently under vine cultivation. Roughly 60 wineries as associate commercial winery members on our association. I want to share a little bit of my background with you briefly. With 35 years in marketing and advertising and promotions and branding, I cut my teeth at Rollerblade in the early days and helped launch the DirecTV satellite system nationwide. So my skill set is scaling. And those for-profit organizations and ad agencies that I work for, I've taken that experience and I'm now trying to apply it to this nonprofit. Big steps. Currently the marketing director for the MGGA, the conference director for our annual conference here, which generates about 500 attendees every year, 40 speakers, 50 trade show exhibitors. It's 3 days of wine making, vineyard management, business sessions, evening events for awards ceremonies, and public wine fest events. And this all was grown from mostly an internal need for developing a knowledge base for new growers, new winemakers. And we've turned it into a or added a public face to it now with an annual wine tasting sampling event with now 1,500 public tickets being sold. And you're all invited to come to that in about a month. All of this is done on a volunteer basis. The MGGA is a nonprofit, and it's technically not sustainable the way that it's set up, so any funding assistance would be greatly appreciated. The program here, again, I'll just briefly use it as an example. Three tracks, 3 days, a lot of information. It has been supported very generously by Minnesota Grown for several years as a sponsor, and we appreciate that going forward, too. As a quick aside, every year when we produce this conference, there are these evening events, awards. The wines that are presented are not just grown in Minnesota. I have Shippers award-winning International Cold Climate Conference competition award winners shipping their wines for the gala dinner so we can all partake on the best wines and best food pairing kinds of things during the award ceremonies. Personally, I receive 15 to 20 cases of wine at my own home within about a two-week period every single year. There's no tracking on that. There's no taxation for that coming in. It's an interesting situation for me. The goals of the MGGA and the mission overlap with the goals for the bill here. It's to educate and to promote. The farmers and the winery industry through the conference and through workshops, through the University of Minnesota Horticulture Research Center with growing seminars and winemaking seminars, and also to educate the public. The promotion part of this gets into events and pushing agritourism. That is the one thing that's been a constant, steady growth opportunity for us. And over the last 5 years, we've produced this winery passport book. There is currently a map on it with 50 pinpoints, and those are our 50 participating commercial winery members out of the 60 that we have as members. They're individual dots all over the map, and literally all over the map. There is no cohesive single wine trail with three organizations historically over the last 15 years or so. MGGA has been around for 42 years, and subsets of our members have formed, organized, and control their own events through their own calendar, but they are competing. There are also some regional associations that are now being formed, and there's no overarching guiding light right now. It's individual participation, individual actions on a regional level. But the goal, the MGGA's goal, is to help to organize those. So looking as a horizon kind of comment here, looking down the road, we would have, let's say, five organizations, 5 months during the year, five rotating wine festivals with regional identity. that's a big step from the way it is right now with 50 individual dots on a single map. There's partnershipping to scale this so that it's not just a one-off single event hosted by the MGGA and funded totally by the MGGA. I'm now talking with a couple of large art festivals, Wayzata Art Experience, if they've ever gone out for that. It's 10,000 people in 2 days. That would be a huge opportunity for 40 wineries to be able to sell up to 6 bottles per person in that event environment.
Mr. Underzon, we have a question here. Representative Miller.
I can wait until he's done with his presentation.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
And I'm going to wrap up here in a second. So the funding would support the conference. Right now, there are conferences in other states, Missouri, Michigan, New York, for example. Their conferences are all subsidized. It allows all of those growers to go to those conferences at a much reduced rate. Our event is roughly a $300,000 management event. Again, all volunteer, not necessarily sustainable, so that would be a very helpful thing for the funding to be applied to that. There is an AVA research.
We'll bring you up.
Okay. There's a American Viticulture Area is a technical federal TTB designation. There are 2 AVAs in the state of Minnesota, one down Winona and South, or Hastings and South. Which covers actually 4 states, the Upper Mississippi River Valley AVA. There are 30,000 square miles over those 4 state locations, and there is a 17 square mile AVA up in Alexandria Lakes area. The hope through research, funding, and a lot of organization over the next 3 to 5 years would be to build additional AVAs in Minnesota so that we can compete, you know, on a messaging basis. And the last thing here, it has to do with festivals, the regional rollout of festivals, which then drives agritourism back to the host zone or the host AVA or the host region for those individual festivals.
Now, Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a brief comment to support what they're saying. And, sir, I'm sorry, I came back in after you left. What's your name?
My name is Steve Unverzot.
Unverzot. Great. A name I'm not going to get right. So,
I have troublesome mornings.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to encourage the committee to really support this. I can tell you that in my district alone, I have two wineries, vineyards, a couple more just outside the district, and it's everything that Mr. Unversock has said. It has really expanded. People coming out, they typically have the places open for the weekends. They oftentimes have weddings at them, things like that. It's really gaining traction and gaining attraction. And what I also like, Mr. Chair, is that it's younger people that are coming back out into rural areas to do these. So I fully support your effort to form this organization formally and move forward, and I look forward to seeing what it's going to look like in the future. So thank you.
Mm-hmm. Good. Next testifier is Matt Clark. Is he in the house? Very good. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Matt Clark. I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Horticultural Sciences at the University of Minnesota. Today I'm speaking on behalf of the industry and as myself as a professional and interested in this business and not representing the university with my statements. I just want to make a few comments in general about our industry and the role the university has played in growth with agrotourism and the industry in general. So I just made a few notes. We've seen a lot of growth in this industry over the last 40 years, with the primary growth happening within the last 5 to 10 years, where 40 to 50% of new wineries and new vineyards are being established. As Steve mentioned, there's about 60 wineries in the state. That doesn't include some of the cideries that we also work with, and people who are getting into this business, establishing vineyards, and are looking to get into producing wine and haven't come to market quite yet. 50% of our producers operate on 5 acres or less producing grapes, so they're not huge in terms of total acreage across the state, but we do see growth with Some producers, some in the audience today, produce 30 acres or more, and in a current grower who has now 60 acres under vines in Minnesota. So we're seeing a lot of growth in people expanding their vineyard establishments and contributing to the growth of the economy for the state. We see that about 30% of the industry, which is about $80 million a year, is for the wineries, about 30% for the vineyards, and then about 30% of that is related to the agro and ecotourism that goes along with visiting the wineries and purchasing wines and other point-of-sale items. The university has been involved since the late 1970s in developing wine grape cultivars. In 1997, we released Frontenac, which has propelled Minnesota, as long as many other states in cold climate regions, to actually grow grapes and produce wine, which is something that people ask me all over the country, why are you doing this, and can Minnesota really do this? And the answer is yes, and we've seen that continued growth. We fast forward 20 years. Last year we released Itasca, which is Minnesota's newest white wine variety, which we think is going to have some major impacts, not only here in Minnesota, but around the world, as a new way to grow cold, hardy grapes that produce dry-style white wine, something that you might purchase normally that was grown in the Mediterranean climates or from California. So we're pretty excited about that. Other things that my project does, in addition to applied research, is that we do extension. So we work with growers and winemakers. Some of our most successful things that we've done this past year are doing winemaker roundtables, where we invite winemakers from around the state, and we also get people coming from Wisconsin and Iowa to come and participate and learn how to make wines better so that we can continue to improve the products that we put in front of our consumers and to grow that business. We work with training tasting room staff, with helping people figure out how to get into markets, identify ways to continue to make money at this business, as agriculture and wine production and sales is as challenging, as you all know. We continue to have needs for more extension, more applied research, and more education opportunities, and Steve indicated that with his testimony also. This bill would allow us to have access to some grant opportunities to continue to reach our producers, both in the winery side and also in viticulture, to ensure that we have continued crop successes in terms of what's happening with climate change, new pests and diseases, and also to continue to propel how we make wines to make sure that we're producing the best quality product that we can get into our consumers' hands. I just finished calculating some data last night, so I'm going to give you some points. We did a survey of our growers in 2017. Only 42 responded with enough information. That's maybe a third of our total number of growers in the state. I'm happy to report that from those 42 growers who produce and sell their grapes, that they produced nearly 1 million pounds of grapes this past year, which is really outstanding. We can certainly do more than that with additional education and insights on best practices. Again, that totally underestimates the total amount of grapes that were produced. And our growers are making about 82 cents per pound on average, which is above some of the national averages for grapes produced around the country. So I'm happy to answer any questions if you have them. Otherwise, that concludes my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Clark. It's just mentioned that that's amazing. We can beat some of the yields of other states and do a great job. So thank you. Representative Munson?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I also want to add that I am a grape grower. I joined the Minnesota Grape Growers Association in 2004. We had 2,000 grapevines planted, 4 acres, and we really enjoy the cold climate conference that you guys put on. It's a fantastic event. Mr. Chair, I renew my motion that House File 1831, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Regulatory Reform.
Thank you very much. Any other questions from members? If not, thanks, Mr. Clark. Next up, we have Mike Kesner and Jenny Ellenbecker, if they're in the audience. And by the way, I'm remiss. We have a new member on our committee this year, and Representative Munson, glad to have your expertise. Just take a minute and tell us your background, and you mentioned you grow grapes, but what do you like to do?
Yeah, well, we do grow grapes. My wife and I, we live in southwestern Minnesota in a rural area, but the cost of land for farming was really cost prohibitive for us, so we started growing specialty crops. We grow grapes, and then we also grow hops. We have a partnership with our family, and we have about 7 acres of hops we grow for the Minnesota beer industry. So I also started the Minnesota Grape Growers Association and in the line of the Minnesota Minnesota Hop Growers Association, in the line of the Grape Growers Association. So I'm a specialty crop advocate, and I think it'll be important for industries like this on the committee.
A couple of fine endeavors, so thank you much, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Mike Kesner and Jenny Ellenbecker, good morning. Introduce yourselves before you start your testimony, and let's go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mike Kesner. My wife and I operate North Folk Winery up in northwest Chisago County, not that far from here, easy drive for the weekend if you're interested. We began our operation in 2008. The reason we got in this was the whole notion of growing grapes and making wine, teaching other people how to make wine, and to bring something interesting into our local community, which we've done. A lot of social events, as have been discussed as earlier, but I do want to emphasize the help from the Grape Growers Association, their annual conference, University of Minnesota's the research, and their roundtables have been hugely helpful in making our winemaking production more sophisticated, learning how to make better wine. I would the fiscal impact, just some numbers to give you an idea. We're a small operation, about 1,000 cases a year. That sounds like a lot, but it's not. It's also a part-time gig for my wife and I, which there's nothing part-time about growing fruit and making wine, by the way. It never ends. Actually, it's like a circle. But since we started in 2008, last year we passed the $1 million mark of money invested in about a 50-mile radius, buying fruit, equipment, building supplies, paying our part-time staff. So it's a small, you know, in about a nine-year period, that's not a whole lot of money, but we're growing, and we're just one winery. So, and
Thank you. My name is Jenny Ellenbecker. I own a winery with my husband over there. We own Round Lake Vineyards and Winery, located in southwest Minnesota. Round Lake is a town, big town of 200, maybe 300 people. It's located near Worthington, Minnesota. I have to say that or they'll go, where? There's Round Lake up here in Minneapolis, but nobody knows where we're at. We started growing in 2006 with 5 acres. Now, like I said, we manage 30. It's a full-time job for us. We also have an ad agency because we have to support the winery, as we all know. MGGA has given us, we get lots of education, but and it is growing. We'd like to increase. It's just that education point, and we do need more vines in Minnesota that produce good quality, because if we can produce that quality fruit, our wines are getting better. We're making quality wine in the industry. So, and if we give back. Oh, the amount of people that we hire, how many part-time employees do we have?
Huh?
15 part-time employees in the summer, or in the winter, it's a little less. We're open year-round, 7 days a week. We have weddings every Saturday. We're booked from beginning of April till the end of November. And then we do all sorts of other events that we have going on. Run Before Wine, 5K runs, different events. Fun for our little community, bringing them into our town. The local gas stations, Worthington, people like to stay over as they get down there. So it's agritourism, agribusiness.
Very good. Questions from members? My wife liked to pick grapes. There was a winery back in our area, and at that time, you'd take a 5-gallon pail out there with a scissors. Is that how you pick the grapes today, too?
It's the slowest way to do it.
But it's a labor of love, I can tell. Very good. Well, thank you very much for coming up, and good luck in your wineries. Anybody else in the audience who would care to testify on the bill? If not, any final comments, Representative Lunan?
I just ask members that we keep this bill moving. We've got, like the chairman said, a lot of stops to make.
Very good. Representative Munson, would you care to renew your motion?
Renew my motion to that the House file 1831, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Regulatory Reform.
Okay. And with that, members all in favor of the motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same side. Motion passes, and the bill is on its way. Good luck, Representative. Next bill up was going to be Chair Hamilton. Is he on his way? Okay, we could do, I had one last bill. Should we do that one now? Or do you want to wait? Maybe we should wait. Anybody know any good wine stories? Representative Johnson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think where I live, there's excellent wine stories. I'm thinking of one winery that's across the road from my district. I believe it's in Representative Munson's district, Chancasco Wines, which has really been a successful winery. But what's intriguing to me is it's local investors, and they took a property that is absolutely beautiful and rebuilt it into a what has become a public space, but privately financed, and I'm fascinated by that the role that's played when private funds are used to create a space that the public just enjoys and is used in many different ways. And so come to South Central Minnesota, check out Representative Munson's grapes, and then enjoy those grapes at other wineries. And there's a lot to be done. That's my story for the day.
Very good, thank you. And also, the university's done a great job in breeding some of these cold weather hardy grapes, and they're actually being grown up in northern Minnesota as well. So the university has played a big role in bringing some of these grapes to market that are able to survive most years in our northern climates. We'll just wait another minute. Chair Hamilton has one bill and I have one bill, but if the chair is on his way, we will wait a couple of minutes. Representative Munson, you mentioned you grew grapes and hops. They both fit into the beverage industry. What do you see down the road, both growing industries, in your opinion?
Well, I think that in order to get kids to move back to the farm, it's great to have other options for crops that use less land. And hops like grapes are a high labor intensive crop, so it takes a younger group of people to grow them. But the hops actually used to be grown here in the Midwest, but we had fungus come through in the teens that kind of decimated the industry. So they moved out to Oregon, where they can grow them in an arid climate and irrigate. So, but now that we have broad spectrum fungicides, the industry's taken off, and I've formed that nonprofit to really grow the industry here in Minnesota. We have probably 180 acres planted so far, but we're growing rapidly. The Minnesota Hop Growers Association started with just three of us, and now we've got about 300 members. It's a great industry with a lot of breweries popping up here that like to use hops.
Representative Nornes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Munson. I'm over here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just wondered, is it possible to come and stomp those grapes? Do you still do that?
So we actually don't have a vineyard.
Munson, go ahead.
I'm sorry. Oh. Yeah, we don't have a vineyard. We're a farmer, so we sell them to a local vineyard. There's a vineyard in Mankato where they do, I'm sure, a little bit of grape stomp, but they don't use that to actually make the grapes because
it sounds like much fun.
Yeah.
Very good. Welcome, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next bill up on the agenda is, I believe it's 2982, correct?
That is correct.
And Representative Nornes, would you care to move the bill?
I move that House File 2982 be referred to the Committee on Civil Law and Data Practice.
And Chair Hamilton, I believe you have a delete all amendment.
Do I? Yes. I don't have a copy.
I also move the House File 2982 DE1 amendment.
Very good. Oh. Any questions on the amendment? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Same sign, no. Amendment is approved. Chair Hamilton, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. As we know, the University of Minnesota, they're leaders on a number of research projects and ag research projects in particular. And in order to get a greater rate of participation in the research studies, we are classifying ag research data collected, received, and maintained by the U to be classified as private data. And, Mr. Chairman, I do have a testifier here that I'd like to turn it over to at this time.
Very good. Good morning, Doctor. Go ahead. Good
morning. Thank you, Chair Anderson, members of the committee, and Chair Hamilton for supporting the legislation. I'm Brian Boer. I'm Dean of the College of Food, Agricultural, and Natural Resource Sciences at the University of Minnesota. On behalf of the University of Minnesota, I'm asking your support for language that strengthens data privacy and protection for all farm data used in research purposes by the University of Minnesota. Because farm data is often private, we want to assure that it has the same protection as, for example, human health care data. Sometimes we call it HIPAA for farmers. This legislation would accomplish that goal by adding a direct statement of privacy and acceptable uses into law for farm data provided to the university voluntarily. This would match the privacy of farm data already provided to the Minnesota Department of Agriculture by existing legislation. A little bit about why it's necessary now and some of the changes in what's happening with our ability to capture and utilize data and research. The University of Minnesota has collected farm-level data for almost 100 years in farm business management programs, for example. Usually the individuals participating sign agreements for privacy, and this then assures we cannot disclose that individual data. We want to assure the same level of data or same level of privacy for all farm data that is voluntarily provided, regardless of the source. The reasons for that now include, increasingly, we're collecting data on actual field conditions, and that means we know the location of the data, and then that can be used to reveal farmer data. We often work with agencies or businesses that provide farmer data that is geo-referenced, allowing for identification, and it is not clear that that protection that we have for privacy extends to those circumstances. We're also increasingly gathering what we call passive data that has specific location reference. And, for example, data captured by sophisticated satellite imagery can now be used to obtain sub-meter level, that's 1 meter, about 3 feet, sub-meter level basis, and show what crops are planted, their stage of maturity, the health of the plants, possible pest infestations, soil types, and topography of the land it's growing on, and very specific spatial information and potential for identification. Combined with the work we do in advanced machine learning using that data, it creates an unprecedented ability to stitch together data to identify specific geographical features and therefore create a risk of involuntary identification. We want to assure that this private data remains private. Not doing so would also impede our ability to use the data as de-identified information for public good research. At the university, this provides greater privacy assurance that increases others' willingness to share their data with the university and would further enable our advanced state-of-the-art analytics and for public good research that supports improving ag productivity and profitability, sustainability for farmers, improved soil health, water quality, climate adaptation practices, and improved pest and disease management and crop systems, and improves the quality of public policies related to agricultural and natural resource management practices by enabling science-based information and research applicable in real-world complexities farmers face, not just in our laboratories. In summary, the legislation changes proposed would assure all farm data is subject to a level of perfection as other private data, that the university, as a neutral party, can continue to work confidently with agricultural data across farmers, business, government agencies, and others without compromising a farmer's data security and privacy, and that the university, with its world-class capabilities in agricultural informatics, will be able to effectively conduct research on agricultural practices and environmental outcomes, leading to rapid advances in smart or precision agriculture you heard about earlier today and related policies for improving agroecologies. Again, Mr. Chair, Chair Hamilton, thank you for, and the committee, thank you for the support of the university and support of this legislation.
Thanks, Dr. Boer. Questions from members? I had one, Dr. Boer. I don't know if you do research in collaboration with private firms, but if you do, would this legislation protect that data when you work alongside private?
Chair Anderson, yes, it would. In many cases, when we do individual research, whether it's an individual as an individual or as a company, it's large enough practice that we actually can have service agreements that say we will not disclose data, and then we're bound by that. Okay. The point of this is that oftentimes we're now getting this sort of passive data because of that work, and we're concerned that we are able to many times stitch together what's happening in a particular acreage, and then that becomes identifiable. Okay. And we're concerned about that becoming an avenue to get at those private issues.
It's a big topic among those in agriculture. So thank you for your work and Chair Hamilton for bringing the bill forward. Question from Representative Bly.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. So I was looking at the statutes and the changes that are being made, and I don't question the need for the data privacy and able to get people to participate and all that. But it seemed to me that the way that it's phrased in statute, there's more kind of specificity of what kind of data, and this seems a little more general, but so I just wanted to make sure I understood some of the terms used. Can you tell me what an agricultural informatics platform is? Can you explain that to me so I understand what that means?
Yes,
Dr. Burr?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Bly. The agroinformatics platform is actually essentially a database. It's literally, in our case, a computer. And so what we're doing is we are at the university, we work with the Minnesota Supercomputing Institute to collect data on soil types, soil conditions, what are the insects or beneficial insects oftentimes on the landscape and where are they located so we can track those. And so we've created this specific, it's a virtual space in a sense, platform upon which that data resides. And so that's the data that comes into that is specific to agricultural and the types of work that we do. And so that's what that platform refers to, and it becomes essentially a database that then we would work with to do our research.
Okay. A follow-up?
Follow-up, Representative Bly.
Thank you, Chair. And maybe this is similar to what Chair Anderson was asking, but the phrase, any similar agricultural research database, can you explain that to me or what that might mean?
Dr. Bohr.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Bly. For example, we have the farm management databases we have are not on that database specifically yet, and so we want to make sure that we're in the process of innovating in that to bring that into a common platform so that it's not spread out around the university, so it's more accessible for research purposes. So we anticipate that there are some of these out there that are independent. Another example, we have a database on animal health related issues when we had the avian influenza outbreak. The Board of Animal Health and the University of Minnesota were capturing data on infections from that.
Sure.
And so those are out there as well. So we want to assure that this applies broadly across this area and have the same concerns and circumstances.
Okay. One more follow-up.
Good questions. Follow-up again, Representative.
I guess I want to make sure that we're not protecting the database is important, protecting individuals. Does this at all, protect the public from knowing results of studies or studies in general? And will that, continue to be public information and while you protect the data?
Dr. Bohr?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Bly. That's a great question. It will not in any way impede our ability to report publicly data, public information from our research projects. What it does prevent is individualized, identifiable data. And so we will, in fact, be, as we do research, we have open research policies at the University of Minnesota that in cases where it's not explicitly excluded for IP, for example, if somebody's sharing with us data that protects intellectual property, then we may not. Other than that, without specific exclusion, we would report only aggregate data that could not be identified with a farmer or a specific person. So it doesn't restrict in any way our open policies on research and availability for public good. We think that's a key aspect of this is our ability to do research on things like on water quality, for example, and to be able to work with farmers to gain information in locations is really important to serve that public good, and that's our primary goal.
Thank you. Okay. Very good. Good questions. Representative Salk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I'm going to be in the same space, but I just, for the way my mind has formulated this, I see two types of protection or vulnerability that's here. One is your accumulation of the data, and then because you want to protect it in its assemblage, this, as you said, you got a couple of years worth of this data that goes back, and the fact that that's assembled is what part of its value is, not necessarily the individual data itself. And so this, in some ways, does it identify it as the type of data that then, in the world of the legal understanding of cyber protection and cyber data protection, this is adequately defined so that then it can stand up in that world? That's a question mark.
Dr. Bohr.
Yes, Chair Anderson, Representative Salk. I will say I'm not an attorney, but we've had our general counsel review this.
Yeah.
And it was specifically addressed so that it would protect in cybersecurity space that information being shared. I'll just make an additional comment that one of the advantages of the University of Minnesota is we have very high level of security in our platforms. For example, some of the data we use is actually on a server that's disconnected from the Internet, the reason being that we're trying to prevent cyber attacks on that. And as an aside, it came from our expertise in human medicine, so we've done a lot of work very similar in context of human individuals looking at medical records and their performance. This is very similar. So that capability allows us to have a very high level of both physical security as well as the protection on the legislation. So we've been around this in that context before.
Follow-up, Representative.
Yeah, one final question, but I suspect that you've sort of answered it, and I'll just direct it more completely, that then this also sets up your data so that it is protected from an external claim of public data that should be available to somebody. So let's say an attorney for a gigantic entity, and the value of yours, like I said, is in its date, term, space, and then also in the totality of the data. And so somebody could see great value and be ready to write out a gigantic check for purposes of legally attacking your ability to have this and protect it under public data laws and that sort of thing. But I suspect you may have sort of answered that earlier, is that you've gone to great pains, and I'll sort of give you the answer that I'm searching for, but I appreciate you entertaining this.
Dr. Boer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Salk, yes, we have gone to great pains. In fact, for the data privacy issues, we actually checked with our general counsel yesterday a bit on that similar question, and it is protected in many ways from individual identification. So aggregate data that is non-identifiable is not protected. That's part of our research when we do that. But it's protected, and we actually, if we were to release that data, would be subject to misdemeanor penalties for doing that. So the privacy of it, the individual identification, is very, very stringent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Who says the Ag Committee asks easy questions? That's pretty good. And good job, Dr. Boer. It's a topic, yeah, that's very timely, and it's a good bill. Chair Hamilton, anybody in the audience who would care to comment or testify on the bill? Department of Agriculture.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Whitney Place. I'm the Government Affairs Director at the Department of Agriculture. The Department of Ag is supportive of House File 2982. As agriculture modernizes its use of technology, be it mechanical, biological, environmental, or informatic, agricultural research methods must modernize as well. By protecting these data, the university will have the ability to conduct research using real on-farm information with public results that would inform farmers about production practices and inform the industry and society about agricultural challenges such as agricultural pests and disease and agricultural environmental interactions. The Department of Ag supports these efforts to apply informatic research methodology to Minnesota agriculture. And thank you to Representative Hamilton for bringing the bill forward.
Questions, comments? Representative Salk.
I'm sorry, I just got one. So in your mind, are you also then protecting and or is there a avenue for the Department of Agriculture to gain access of use? So, for instance, like if you have a question, if you have a question that you would want your researchers to be able to have access to this, I mean, when you said like a 100-year data set, I come from Olmsted County, and some of the public may not know, but Mayo Clinic and in connection with IBM has generated a generations-long set of both genomics and disease through family research data set. It is very much like the value set that we're talking about here. But that data set, if it becomes so secure and owned, then your ability as the Department of Ag to get at it, and I'm just going to suggest one. There are ways. One would be that you have the ability to deliver a research request, and they do the research and then give you back the report, or you having access to the data. Those are two different doorways that... So I'll let you answer.
Advice well taken. Any comments?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't think the university would be able to share identifiable data with us, but they could aggregate it and share it with us in the case of a situation where we would need to use the data.
Again, anybody in the audience who'd care to testify?
Mr. Chair, Representative Salk. Just very briefly, we would not be able to do identifiable data to the Department of Agriculture. You'll notice in the language it does has if an individual gives us permission to do that. So we would go back to an individual if that were the case, and we could request that individual could provide it. But beyond that, we couldn't provide that to any entity other than if it were aggregate data that was not identifiable.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Miller. Munson, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did have one question for the University of Minnesota, Dr. Bohr. One of the concerns in my district from constituents is on the issue of spraying crops, and I know that that's a very important issue to understand impacts on yield, and it would be great for your information. And I know I've partnered with the University of Minnesota on studies for specialty crops. Is that data, if farmers provide the chemical they spray and the dates they spray, is that information protected, you know, from, I don't know if it's the Department of Agriculture that would come in for drift through DriftWatch or understanding impacts to neighboring farms? Is that information protected, or can that be brought out in a lawsuit?
Dr. Bohr.
Again, Mr. Chair, Representative, we, in the context of our research, we would, for example, do research on what our application impacts, you know, this conversation about AFREC, the fertilizer research, the rest of the acronym I don't remember, but is the kind of research looking, what's the right application, is it being applied effectively, and we'd be doing research on that. But again, it would not identify any individuals. And that's part of this public good space, is thinking about, we know that farmers are seeking to, as was talked about there too, to minimize their impact on the environment, to improve the outcomes from using those compounds. We'd be doing that research to try to help improve those uses and practices, and that's where the data has value. We would not have we would not be able to give that individual data on anybody to, for example, execute a request, as you described, request for a lawsuit on that as part of that, because that would be individually identifiable data.
Chair Hamilton, any last comments?
Oh, I just want to say, great discussion. Thank you for that, and also I would appreciate the support.
Thank you. And with that, Representative Nornes.
Mr. Chair, I renew my motion that House File 2982, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Civil Law and Data Practices.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion passes, and the bill is on the way. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
I just want to take in the interlude the opportunity for our committee page to introduce himself. Could you grab the microphone and tell us a little bit about who you are and how you got here?
My name is Joseph Davey. I graduated from Metropolitan State University here in St. Paul 2015, and I've just kind of been looking for some new opportunities, and I saw this page position on the House website, and I thought I'd give it a shot. And it's been pretty exciting so far. I'm from Eagan, Minnesota.
Well, we want to thank you for doing that. We appreciate your service to the committee.
Thank you very much.
The next bill on the agenda is House File 2884. Representative Anderson, would you like to move your bill?
I certainly would, Mr. Chair. House File 2884.
Okay. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and I've got the book with me to answer some questions this morning. And you may wonder why this bill is here. I'll give you a short explanation. A package store back in my district, an off-sale liquor store, sells ice. And the water they use to make ice comes from their own establishment. And because of that, they have to have their water tested and things like that, and that's all fine and good. And then they have to get a license from the Department of Agriculture. So that's why we're in this committee this morning. And up until a couple of years ago, the license for this establishment to make and sell ice cost them a total of $77 a year. But evidently some definitions changed, and the license now for this year cost them $799 to sell a couple thousand dollars worth of ice that they make, and they're just asking for some help in wondering why this license fee increased by, what, about 1,000% in a year. And I think the answer is that because of some federal definitions. Now anything you eat or drink, and in this case what you may drink, is classified as food. And when they figure up the cost of a license, you have to add all that you sell to get that license figure. So in this case, in the case of this off-sale package store, the entire amount of proceeds they sell for liquor and beer is added up to come up with a license they have to pay to make ice. And it just, to me, it defies common sense. And in the cost, again, the increase of a, I think, 1,000% in the cost of their license is the reason we have this bill. And what the bill does, Mr. Chair and members, it just exempts or takes away that requirement that they have to add in the cost of their liquor sales when they figure up the cost of their license to make and sell ice, is what the bill does. And, I lost my page. But anyway, the Department of Ag sent out a clarification as to why they were having to do this, but I thought it was interesting at the bottom of their explanation, and it's taken right from the book here, the Bible, Statute 645.17 states that the legislature, when passing the law, did not intend the result to be absurd, impossible of execution, or unreasonable. And to me, this is an example of something being unreasonable, and I would also add absurd to have that cost increase be that large for their license. So that's the reason for the bill and the reason for coming forward today, and I would ask for your support.
Representative Selk, you have a question?
Yeah, I do. Mr. Chair, I would like to ask, I don't know if this is appropriate, I have no clue yet. Most of you know I don't know these rules until I stumble across them. Can I ask Representative Poston a question? Sure. Is that appropriate?
Representative Selk.
Representative Poston, you've got significant amount of experience in this space of food and licenses to deliver and all of that sort of stuff. Can you reflect a bit on this? And then also in my question will be, is this the only facility in the state that's experiencing this new or increased tax on their system? Or is this going to be something that's going to go across to every facility in the state that delivers ice or makes their own ice? So,
Representative Poston?
Mr. Chair, Representative Sock, you know, I am in the restaurant and catering business. Yeah. And in our restaurants, we do not sell ice, and we do not sell it in the catering business, so it doesn't affect us. And I'm like you, this is the first time when I heard about this a few days ago that I was aware that this happened.
Representative Selk, would you direct that question?
Then, Mr. Chair, is this a unique one-person, one-of kind of circumstance, or are we going to try to do something that's more comprehensive so that nobody else gets hooked like this?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have the exact answer to that. I would say that I would think most C-stores and bigger establishments would have their ice brought in, and they would sell the big prepackaged bags that would come from somebody that does this for their livelihood. I don't know how many stores actually make their own ice. I know this one does. So any store that would use their own water to make their own ice could be impacted by this, yes. I don't know the number that would impact.
Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify for or against House File 2884? Seeing none, any closing comments, Representative Anderson?
Well, I thought there was going to be some opposition, so I came all prepared here. But this has some other stops, and again, trying to be reasonable. And if the federal law precludes the definition change, I would like to negotiate or work with the folks that set these fees to somehow reduce them so that this increase wouldn't be as large as it is in this case. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd renew my motion that this bill be on its way to its next stop.
Okay, so Representative Anderson renews his motion that House File 2884 be re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Regulatory Reform. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails.